Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The Democratic Party is kicking off its convention at the Bank of America Stadium in Charlotte, North Carolina today. The party has been criticized for holding the convention in North Carolina because of the state's low union membership and labor conditions. According to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics, southern states have the lowest rates of union membership in the country. Union density is less than 3% in the state. In fact, it has the lowest union membership rate in the nation. According to the North Carolina Department of Labor, the state's employment at will law means that unless there is a specific law or contract providing protections, an employer can fire an employee for any reason or no reason at all. And then the state's right to work legislation bans collective bargaining agreements that require workers to join unions. Now, even though labor will not have a major presence at the convention, major unions have endorsed President Obama, and they are planning to mobilize hundreds of thousands of their members to help him win a second term. So on today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by talking about the relationship between the Democratic Party and organized labor. What is President Obama's record on strengthening unions, labor laws, and collective bargaining? And what has the continued support of labor for the Democratic Party meant for independent labor? Today, we're joined by Bill Fletcher. He's a racial justice, labor, and international activist. He's a senior scholar with the Institute for Policy Studies and a former assistant to the president of the AFL-CIO. He's out with a new book called They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions. Bill and Carl Davidson recently wrote a piece called The 2012 Election Has Little to Do with Obama's Record, Which Is Why We Are Voting for Him. Hi, Bill. Welcome to the show. And we're joined by Mike Elk, third-generation union organizer and labor journalist. He writes for Harper's and The American Prospect. He is a labor reporter for In These Times. And Mike joins us from D.C. Hi, Mike. Welcome to the show.
Great to be on the show.
It's great to have you. So, Mike, why don't I start off with you? What message do you think Democrats are sending to not only unions but workers by having their convention in a state like North Carolina?
Well, I think IBEW President Ed Hill put it best in describing why it was held there, which is that labor is an afterthought. Afterthought was the word Ed Hill used. And that's why so many unions are boycotting it, with the exception of the few of the more ones that are tied into the D.C. political sphere that are kind of really sold out. So I think that's why so many unions are boycotting it, because it's really an afterthought. I mean, think how ironic. The largest grassroots mobilization of the left in the last generation or so was in Wisconsin, but yet over collective bargaining rights. But yet we are holding our Democratic National Convention in a state that that bans collective bargaining for public employees. For the last 20 years, there's been a Democratic governor of North Carolina, but yet public employees still don't have the right to collective bargain. I think it says that the Democratic Party doesn't care about organized labor at all. Even worse, I think having Rahm Emanuel get up and speak tonight. Well, Rahm Emanuel is blocked, has a potential teacher strike looming on his hand in Chicago, and was called yesterday a liar and a bully by the head of the Chicago Teachers Union. Having him speak tonight in prime time, I think, is an ultimate insult to workers everywhere, and continues what I feel is really, you know, in my opinion, I've always felt President Obama as a scab. I mean, during the Honeywell lockout, he flew on an airplane with the CEO of Honeywell to India. You know, it's clear to me Obama is a scab. Sure, he must be a good Democrat when the weather's right. But when it comes to choosing between, you know, some advantage to him and, you know, workers, he always chooses some sort of advantage to him by working with bosses. And that's what a scab does. And so I think, sure, he might be a Democrat, but this is ultimately a scab presidency.
Well, and we'll talk during the show about what's going on in Chicago. There were incredible photos of thousands of teachers in red T-shirts yesterday on the streets of Chicago. Bill Fletcher, are you with us?
I'm here.
Hi, Bill. So hey. What are your thoughts? I'll get you to respond to Mike in a minute, but what message do you think the Democrats are sending to, I don't want to say just union members because there are so few union members now, but just workers across the board by having a convention in the Bank of America Stadium? I understand they're not going to call it the Bank of America Stadium, in an anti-union state like North Carolina.
Well, I actually hold a minority position on this one in organized labor. I think it's great that they're holding this in North Carolina and that it's in Charlotte. I think that when we look at the way that this country is changing in so many ways, the Sun Belt, the South and the Southwest are the growing regions. Of course they're going to hold it there. And but what also gets me in some of the criticisms that are raised is that there's almost like a naivety. I mean, organized labor, for all intents and purposes, gave up organizing the South and the Southwest. Let's just be very clear about that. You know, I've grown up in the union movement. I'm very dedicated to the union movement, but I also see the warts. So, you know, when people start talking about, well, we shouldn't have met in North Carolina, I say, well, damn it, why weren't we organizing in North Carolina? I mean, the United Electrical Workers is one of the few unions that has really dedicated resources to organizing in North Carolina. But for the most part, labor has stayed away from doing strategic organizing in the South and the Southwest. So I don't think that the problem is there. You know, whether it's the Bank of America Stadium, you go to any stadium around this country, it's all being bought up by these corporations. The question is not that symbolism. The question is, what is the party going to say? And what is Obama going to say? I mean, I feel like what Obama should have been saying and should say when he speaks is that he needs to talk with people of the United States about why they're getting their asses kicked by this economy. And that it's not simply about, you know, his presidency, that there's a global situation that people have to understand. And I caught part of the tail end of your the last speaker, and I think that we've got to people in the United States have got to understand that the issue about the economy is about power. It is about power and organization. That's what makes the union movement so critically important. We've got to build up organization so that we actually can become a force in turning this economy around.
So, and that's Mike Elk, a labor reporter with In These Times. You brought up a number of issues here, Bill. For those of us who don't follow labor in the South, now we are reading statistics about how Southern states have the lowest rates of union membership in the country. Paint us a picture. What's happened there over the last couple of decades?
You actually have to go back to the 1940s. In fact, I would say you actually have to go back to Reconstruction. Because, you see, the problem is that in the aftermath of the defeat of Reconstruction by 1877, what you then started to see were incredibly repressive governments that took over office in state after state in the South. And they were repressive not simply against African Americans, although obviously there's great attention to that, as there should be, but they were repressive against any opposition to the governing economic elites in those various states. When the populist movement developed at the tail end of the 19th century that brought together workers and farmers, the elite in the South were completely panicked. And part of what they did in those circumstances was play the race card as a way of demobilizing poor people and working people, farmers and people in urban areas. And they not only played the race card, but they carried out physical repression of workers. In 1912, the Brotherhood of Timber Workers in Louisiana was faced with the state militia when they went on strike. So these folks weren't playing any games. In the 1940s, when the Republicans retook Congress in 1946, which is one of the reasons that those people that talk about not voting in this election have their head somewhere. In 1946, when they took over, among the things that they did was they instituted amendments to the National Labor Relations Act, which are known as the Taft-Hartley Act. And in the Taft-Hartley Act, it permitted something that is misnamed as the right to work laws. And right to work laws are laws that basically say that workers in a unionized facility must be represented by that union, but do not have to pay dues, which is a way of guaranteeing that the union ultimately does not have the resources in order to represent workers fairly. Well, the existence of these right-to-work laws, along with other steps that were taken in the South, absolutely discouraged unions. So after the late 1940s, most unions in the United States gave up organizing in the South and the Southwest. A few continued.
So your message is that you're glad that the Democrats are having the convention in North Carolina because they're sending a message saying we're not giving up on the South.
Precisely.
So Mike, what are your thoughts?
Having a convention in New York City, we don't need to have that convention. I grew up in New York. I love New York. We need to have the convention in places where we're prepared to say we're going to be fighting, and the union movement should be saying, not only is it right to have the convention there, but we're now going to do a major organizing effort in North Carolina to turn it into a union state.
Mike, what are your thoughts on that argument and Bill's assessment of the South giving up on, or the organized labor really giving up on the South?
Well, I think you know, having the DNC in North Carolina, if the Democratic Party was going to attempt to organize, there wouldn't be an issue. But I interviewed the chair of the DNC earlier this year about whether Charlotte City workers who were denied the right to collectively bargain under a Jim Crow-era law should have the right to dues checkoffs, something that other major cities in North Carolina give to unions. Dues checkoff allows for unions, even though they don't have collective bargaining rights, to act as associations and help workers out. You know, the mayor of Charlotte has refused to even give this basic right, which a federal judge just ruled as constitutional, a constitutional right under the First Amendment, since it's freedom of association, to workers in Charlotte. The mayor won't even give it. And I asked Debbie Wasserman Schultz, the head of the DNC, do you feel that workers in Charlotte should have the right to have their union dues deducted from their paychecks if they want to? And she refused to answer the question repeatedly. She dodged it, and then she fled the interview. And I have this all on tape. So I wouldn't have a problem necessarily if the Democratic National Convention came to North Carolina and said, we're going to organize workers. That's not what they're doing. What they're doing is trying to win a few votes in a swing place, and they're rewarding a series of Democratic governors in North Carolina who for the last 20 years have basically abandoned the rights of workers to collectively bargain and have done nothing to help workers collectively bargain. I really think that Obama is forgetting what Martin Luther King died for by holding a convention and saying nothing about the rights of workers to collectively bargain in North Carolina. It's a real disrespect to the memory of Martin Luther King. As for the issue of organizing the South, you know, you want to look at holding the convention there in Charlotte. You know, the UE, which is organizing public workers in North Carolina, is going to be outside of the convention testing for not doing anything to stand up for public workers. Ask me, one of the largest public sector unions in this country with 1.4 million members is sponsoring events at this convention. So what does that say about leverage when they give up money to this dog and pony show while other public sector unions are on the outside? So I think the real issue here is that the labor movement hasn't gotten tough. It hasn't acted always in the best interest of its members. And you've got to wonder why there's so few people that are willing to take the big risk for unions if unions aren't willing to take the big risk for them when it comes to confronting the Democratic Party.
That is Mike Elk. He is a labor reporter with In These Times. We're also joined by Bill Fletcher, racial justice, labor, and activist. And we'd love to hear from you. The basic question is, what message do you think it sends by having the convention in North Carolina at the Bank of America convention stadium? What do you think of Mike's argument and Bill's argument? And what are your thoughts on the Obama administration's relationship with labor? What do you think of his record on strengthening unions, labor laws, collective bargaining? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. So, Bill, what are your thoughts on what Mike says specifically about people like Debbie Wasserman Schultz and some of the higher Democrats in terms of their views on where they stand on labor?
I agree a lot with a lot of what Mike is saying. I guess the way I look at it is that the Democratic Party is not a workers' party. It never has been. It has been a party that at different points has had great influence by unions, but it's always been dominated by a different section of corporate America than the Republicans were. But I guess the way I look at it is this, that Obama has always been a corporate liberal. The question is, what are we doing to force change? Not whether we're putting hope in him, but what are we actually doing? I think that the example of the UE and AFSCME protesting is very good. But, I mean, when Obama took over, most of organized labor gave him a pass. And not just organized labor. Most liberals and progressives took the position that we can't put too much pressure on him because that would make him look bad, et cetera, that we've got to give him space. And that was absolutely the wrong thing to do. We shouldn't have given him any space. From the very beginning, there needed to be pressure on this administration. And I think that history shows us time and again. I mean, when Mike was talking about King, I'm not going to get into whether this is a betrayal of King's legacy. But what I will say is that the legacy of King was a legacy of social mobilization, whether he was mobilizing against Democrats or anyone else. I mean, when you look at the early 1960s, the Kennedy administration was not particularly a great friend of black America. They had to be forced. Johnson, again, had to be forced. The idea was not going and begging these guys, not going taking their word for different things. The issue was about force. It was about social mobilization. And that lesson is a lesson that many of us seem to have lost, whereas the political right seems to keep remembering that, because they will hold their elected officials accountable.
Well, and I have to say, Bill, I mean, right after Obama was elected, you did have single-payer activists who got arrested constantly, anti-war activists. The disability rights community flies to D.C. on a regular basis. They're getting arrested in their wheelchairs. So it's not like people were, on the couch sleeping after he got arrested. I mean, they were raising their voices. It's just they didn't get much media coverage.
No, I would disagree with you. Yeah, I mean, there were actions. There's no question about that. People were active. What I'm talking about is something very different. I'm talking about a level of organization where you actually are disruptive, where you're actually touching a critical mass of people, much the way that the Occupy movement took on. The Occupy movement, when it started, the media tried to ignore it, and they couldn't. People stayed, and it expanded. We're not just talking about an action here, an action there. All of us have been to demonstrations, countless demonstrations, sometimes phenomenally large demonstrations. We're going to have to figure out if that's not going to get attention, then what will? We've got to go further. And people understand, the political leaders understand that. Obama understood from the lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender movement. They heard their message. They've heard messages from the immigrant rights movement. But many of us, they haven't heard.
Mike, do you agree with that? You cover actions. Do you think that organized labor sat down and gave Obama a pass after he was elected?
Well, let's look at what happened here. The immigrant rights community, Luis Gutierrez went to the fence of the White House, chained himself to the fence of the White House. They had, at least Obama gave a speech on the subject of immigration reform and maybe helped some folks with this deferred action, helping out some of the dreamers. Look at the gay rights community. Dan Choi chained himself to the fence of the White House. At least the White House passed Don't Ask, Don't Tell on same-sex benefits for federal employees. Look at the environmental movement. Bill McKibben and all those folks went down. They got arrested in front of the White House. And, it delayed, at least for now, the Keystone Pipeline. what did Rich Trumka, what did the president of the AFL-CIO, what did Mary Kay Henry, president of SEIU, and Bob King, president of UAW, do? They didn't chain themselves to the fence of the White House. They went and they met in the White House dozens of times. And they refused in key situations to say the kind of critical things that need to be said. I mean, this is not to say, I mean, in off-election years, Rich Trumka is more critical of the White House than people like Bob King and Mary Kay Henry. But in an election year like this, you know, Rich will say, oh, yeah, we have our disappointments, but not get very specific. And I think Bill's right in that, you know, there were citizens engaged in actions, but I think the leaders of the institutions that are sitting down at the table never tried to implement these on a large enough scale. And I also think, you know, from being here in D.C., that when, you know, there, you know, when Obama is sitting at the table with heads of unions or heads of progressive groups, and they tell them, you know, and they're not really sticking it to them and threatening them, then he thinks everything is fine, despite what, you know, single-payer activists might be doing elsewhere. I mean, you know, you were talking about disability advocates, and I remember there was a big D.C. conference sponsored by a lot of unions for Campaign for America's Future, and Nancy Pelosi, the congresswoman out there in San Fran, was speaking, and a number of disability advocates from ADAPT started heckling her during her speech and about, you know, her not standing up with them on disability issues and Obamacare. And they started heckling her, and I remember the reaction of people in the crowd, mainly, you know, union bureaucrats and, you know, big progressive organization staffers, is that they started booing. Booing these ADAPT advocates, these disability advocates that were doing this because they were rocking the boat and that they were interrupting their nice powwow. I just thought that was all you need to know about the problem of liberals in D.C., which is that a lot of them are personally friends with the Democratic administration, and they don't want to rock any boats. And so I think that sends the wrong message. I think the most important thing progressives could do in order to change the labor movement is to take back organized labor. If you look at right now, if you cap the salary, this is according to Labor Notes, which is a pro-union newspaper, cap the salary of every union official country at $100,000, you'd save the labor movement $290 million a year. That's a lot of money. That's according to the Department of Labor record.
What's their average salary now?
It varies from union, but, I mean, you know, you've got something like 10,000 union officials, total compensation, I meant earlier, making a total compensation of over 100,000. You have, I know this, that there's 1,200 union officials making above 150,000 in salary. And you have unions like the Longshoremen out there on the West Coast that cap their salary, as well as the UE. And, you know, if you look at, you know, these big union institutions, they're like any other institution, they're totally dysfunctional for the most part. I mean, there's some unions that really do a good job, and there's parts of unions that sort of do good jobs and then don't. And then there's some unions that are just completely chaotic and dysfunctional and don't do much to stand up for their members.
Hold that thought, Mike. We're going to take a quick break. Today we're talking on Your Call about the relationship between the Democratic Party and labor as it kicks off its convention today at the Bank of America Stadium in Charlotte, North Carolina. The party has been criticized for holding the convention there because of the state's low union membership. North Carolina has the lowest union membership rate in the nation. Mike Elk says it's a slap in the face to workers, whereas Bill Fletcher says it sends a message that the Democrats are not giving up on the South. Where do you stand on this? And what do you think it will take to take back organized labor? What do you think? How should unions, where do they go from here at a time when wages are low and they are fighting for some kind of equality here? If you're listening to Your Call, we'll be back after this.
This is Ira Glass of This American Life, and you're listening to 91.7 KALW San Francisco. I have no idea why this is their tagline. Their tagline is the oldest FM station west of the Mississippi, as if you were choosing your radio station like a fine wine based on its age. But if that is your choice of radio station, if you're looking for the oldest one, this would be the oldest one. 91.7 KALW.
San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about our show at yourcallradio.org. And we'd love to hear from you to chat with us about today's issue of labor. What are your thoughts about the convention that kicks off today? What about the relationship between the Democrats and labor? How do you think labor can get its power back? How do you think, what will it take to take back organized labor? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts on where the president stands on things like labor laws and wages, for example? There were a lot of calls for him to make an argument for minimum wage increases yesterday. A lot of people say that's a start. At least we can do that. So what are your thoughts on where the Democrats stand on these issues? You can also leave a comment, yourcallradio.org, or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Bill Fletcher, racial justice and labor activist. His new book is They're Bankrupting Us and 20 Other Myths About Unions. You can see a piece that Bill and Carl Davidson recently wrote called The 2012 Election Has Little to Do with Obama's Record, Which Is Why We Are Voting for Him. That's up at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined by Mike Elk, a third-generation union organizer, although now he's working full-time as a labor reporter for In These Times. And let's go to our caller. Let's hear from Eileen in Mountain View. Hi, Eileen.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
You know, I had a dream once a long time ago, about 20 years ago. I've never had a chance to really tell anybody about it. And I'm not associated with the labor union movement at all, so I don't know why I had this dream. But in this dream, I woke up thinking, okay, everybody has to strike at once. And that got me thinking about wondering if your guests can tell me how united the labor union is. I mean, you know, most human endeavors, everybody's got their own little piece of the territory. And not only that, but they have to fight with their reputation in big media. And it would be really nice to hear something supportive from the Democrats, but I don't have any illusions about Obama anymore. But I would like to hear if they think they can all work together.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in. What are your thoughts on that, Bill?
What the caller is describing is what's called a general strike. And I think every union organizer I've ever met has dreamed, salivated at the idea of a general strike. They're illegal in the United States, but more importantly, they're very hard to coordinate. And that goes to the issue that the call is raising. There are significant divisions within the House of Organized Labor. I think that in time they can be overcome. But it goes back to something that Mike was raising, which is the absence of a progressive vision about where this movement needs to go. We have a movement that is in many ways stuck. There's some good people that are in leadership. There's some not so good people in leadership. But the framework that they're operating in, they're refusing to accept the gravity of our situation, and that this is a time where you have to take great risks. And you have to challenge power, including the power of people that we might consider friends. I mean, I think that the Democrats need to be pressured, and that it was a failure of leadership that there wasn't consistent pressure on it.
So why don't you lay out a vision? What would this look like?
I think that the vision would be what I call social justice unionism. It basically is that the union regains its role as the champion of economic justice, not just for the people that it represents, that the union the union movement is at the forefront of the struggle for single-payer health care, that the union movement is at the forefront of building alliances in our cities for a new economic development strategy. I think that it's a union movement that recognizes that the unemployed need to be organized. And that they need to be organized into their own organizations in order to pressure for jobs. It's a union movement that does what Mike was saying, that where its leaders are prepared to take certain risks, which may mean that people are going to go to jail for a little while.
And Mike, how would you lay this out? A new report just came out from the National Employment Law Project, and they found that the majority of new jobs being created right now pay between $7.69 and $13.38 an hour.
Yeah, I certainly agree with what Bill is saying. And I think something needs to be done to change this. Folks, I think need to start organizing, need to start thinking about it. We need to make big changes in the culture of how we do these things. But while, a general strike is very difficult to pull off, I think the one thing that has been missing from American labor relations are strikes in general. They're very tough to pull off because of Taft-Hartley and other laws. If workers go out and strike and it's deemed an economic strike, not an unfair labor practice strike, workers can be permanently replaced by scabs, and so they're difficult. I still think we have to try with strikes, and so many unions, they don't even really put it on the table. And I think, what's happening in Chicago now, 26,000 teachers and support staff have set a strike date, September 10th. I think what they're doing there is important, and I think it really needs to be embraced at the national level. I mean, Randy Weingarten, who's the president of the AFT, there was a rally of 18,000, Chicago teachers yesterday. Randy Weingarten was in Pittsburgh instead of being out on the front lines leading her union. Today she's in North Carolina, and she's not saying a word really criticizing ROMP. She's sort of supporting it, but it's not a huge fight for the AFT, which is one of the largest teachers' unions. It's something that the Chicago teachers are relatively doing on their own with a little bit of support from the national. And I think national labor unions have to find these fights and really invest in them and not be afraid to upset with people like ROMP. And maybe down the road somewhere that leads to larger scale worker uprisings and actions throughout cities and regions. But I think strikes are how you stop concessions, and it's not enough to organize. We also have to fight for good jobs, and the only way to do that is with the power of the strike. Really.
Did you say that there were 18,000 people on the streets yesterday?
In Chicago, yeah.
Wow. We have an email from Catherine in Richmond who says, "We remember FDR for his progressive policies during the Great Depression, but FDR did much of this against his own class interests, but had the prescience to tell his advisors that they would have to force him to do what was needed to turn around the desperate labor situation in 1933, and they did. I bet Eleanor had a lot to do with that, too." Bill, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's absolutely true. When Roosevelt was elected in 1932, he was a sort of lackluster Democrat. And his initial concept for the New Deal was modeled on Mussolini's corporate state rather than on anything that was particularly left-wing. But it was the mobilization of workers, the 1934 general strikes, for example, or the organizing of the unemployed, that really pushed Roosevelt. But the other thing that pushed Roosevelt, which is analogous to today, is that the extreme right wing was vehemently against any concessions to working people, and in fact began discussing the possibility of a military coup against Roosevelt. When Roosevelt understood that he wasn't getting any traction, even among members of his own class, and he was trying to protect the system, he then had to look for other allies. One of the things that we're looking at right now is that even the relatively minor changes, in many cases, that I shouldn't put it like that, but some of the reforms that President Obama has introduced that are far short of what many of us want have gotten vicious attacks, or received vicious attacks from the right. And Obama's tendency is to compromise. We need to be the force that really says there is no turning back.
Well, we have an email from Sue who says unions could get their membership more engaged. Instead of top-down requests to make phone calls for Democrats, unions need bottom-up requests from their members. What do their members want leadership to do? As it stands, most unions have no forum for members to speak with each other online and no way for members to engage. So that's a great question. If you are a union member, what do you want leadership to do? And what are your thoughts about where we are right now? What will it take to strengthen organized labor? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. And what message do you think the Dems are sending you by having their convention at the B of A Stadium in Charlotte, North Carolina? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or post to yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Richard in Oakland. Hi, Richard.
Great discussion.
Hello, Richard.
Can you hear me?
Hi. Go ahead.
First of all, I'd like to say that I think it's really smart for the Democrats to hold their convention in a battleground state in a very public venue, because it's the overarching message that's important. Second of all, I have a question for the speakers. Number one, unionization is a means to an end, not an institution. And fair compensation is the end. And I think there are a lot of models out there where profit sharing is a model for business. And I was wondering if the speakers see any potential future where unions aren't necessary at all.
Mike, do you want to take that one first?
I don't ever see a future where unions aren't necessary. Even most unions have staff unions. I think any time workers need a voice on a job, they need to have it. I mean, yeah.
And Bill?
No, I think that... I agree with Mike. I don't see it as feasible or foreseeable. And I think particularly in a capitalist system, when you have such a power imbalance, it's very difficult to imagine a situation where you wouldn't have or need unions.
All right. Well, thank you for calling, Richard. And let's hear from another Richard in San Pablo. Hi, Richard. Welcome to the show.
Good morning. Happy to be on the show. I was a worker in North Carolina for 5 years. I was a college professor, and I taught at a minority college in Charlotte. And I found some interesting things of real hostility toward unions. Once when I argued or disagreed with something the president said he wanted, I was hired at the same time as another faculty member, and that faculty member got a raise that year, and I didn't. And there was no difference in our time of service or quality of service or anything, but I objected to something, and it cost me some money then. But later, I decided, let's see what happens about organizing. And I wrote a newsletter and gave it to all the faculty, and even handed one to the president at a faculty meeting. And I called for a good, strong union to make working conditions better for us as faculty and salaries. For example, nobody was getting tenure. There was a faculty rule book that theoretically the faculty had negotiated with the president, but he took out whatever he didn't like. And they said after 10 years in this rule book, you can be considered for tenure, but nobody ever got tenure. We just worked year for year and year after year. And he spoke to the faculty meeting and said, hey, I can fire anybody I want, and I can hire anybody I want, and I'll go to every court in the nation to do it. And he was shouting at us at a faculty meeting. And I said, this place needs a good union. And I suggested it, but that didn't get very far. I got threatened with we're going to give you one last year here, and if you behave, we'll continue for next year, and if you don't, you're gone. And happily, I got a job offer elsewhere. And interestingly enough, I was happy to leave because of the absolute submission of faculty, and faculty sometimes are organized. Later on, some years later, I worked in, of all places, Nebraska, which is a right-to-work state, but we had a union at the college where I worked, and our salaries were about, we were close to the state line between North Carolina, between Nebraska, where I worked, and South Dakota. And Nebraska salaries at our school, because we had a union, were about one-third higher than average faculty salaries in one state north in South Dakota. And they didn't have unions. Well,
thank you for calling in, Richard, that the data shows the salary information in terms of union and non-union, and we can grab that in just a minute. But thank you for calling and sharing that personal story. And we'd love to hear from you if you've got a personal story about what it was like to be in a union. What was the experience like for you? And what's happening right now, we're going to hear from someone in just a couple of minutes. Some people are working in union jobs and then getting fired and working in non-union jobs. So if that's your situation, we'd love to hear from you. What are your thoughts about how unions should use their political power? What is most effective, and what will it take to strengthen organized labor? 866-798-8255. You can also leave a message at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We're joined today by Mike Elk, labor reporter for In These Times, and Bill Fletcher, racial justice and labor activist. And Bill, I just wanted to ask you a question, because it is fascinating to look at these studies to see where the majority of jobs are being created. And again, we're talking about low-wage jobs for the most part. What about all of these workers who don't have any sort of representation?
Well, that's in some ways a big part of the future of organized labor, if we're going to have a future, which is to go after low-wage workers. But in doing it, we have to organize very differently. Our strategy and forms of organization, they're just simply going to be different. If you go into a low-wage workplace, one of the things that you encounter, which those organizers in the textile and garment industries encountered for years, is that the tendency of the owners to close, move, as well as workers, when they encounter various problems, quitting, as opposed to organizing. So we have to figure out what form of organization makes sense. And, you know, if you're organizing in a place that has 5 or 10 people, that kind of organization is going to be very different than an auto plant that has 1,000 workers. So low-wage workers, workers that are in what's called a precarious sector, are the people that we have to figure out a way to organize.
Well, let's hear from one of those workers. I'd like to welcome Ruben Valadez to the show. Ruben was a union member a couple of years ago at an electronics shop, but was let go because of the economic crisis. He got a job, a contract job, with Ware Staff in February. He works the midnight shift, loading and unloading boxes for Walmart. So while most of us are sleeping, he is loading 250 boxes an hour, making $8.50 an hour with no benefits. Hi, Ruben. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Thanks so much for joining us. So, Ruben, you're in this interesting situation, like so many other workers. If you don't, can I say your age, if you don't mind me?
I'm
61 years old. So you worked for a union shop for, what, 17 years?
Approximately, yes.
And this was just a couple years ago, and now you're working for Ware Staff. And you say that you had no idea workers were actually treated this way. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Right. When I first was hired there, I was hired under the impression that I would be hired as a permanent employee after 90 days. Well, 90 days has come and gone, and I'm finding myself and many other employees that are there, they've been there 9 years, and they're still temps. And with no benefits, no health insurance, no vacation time, no sick time. If you do get sick on a job, you're pretty basically on a suspension. You don't go back to work. The working conditions there are very harsh. It's a cross dock. It's basically a distribution center for Walmart. There's two agencies that hire the labor for Walmart. There's the agency called Select, and I'm with Ware Staff. Like I said before, I worked the third shift, and I get paid $8.50 an hour. When I first worked there, there was only one break and one lunch period. It was I started at 12:30 in the morning, and we would get a break at 2:30 for 15 minutes, and then we'd go up on lunch from 4:30 a.m. till 5 a.m. and work the rest of the shift until you are done with your trailer. And you, the requirement was that you have to move 250 boxes per hour, which is an impossibility. Some of the boxes are small, and they weigh a couple ounces. The vast majority are large boxes, and they can weigh up to 75, 80 pounds apiece. And we pretty much unload everything that Walmart produces, except for food. They can range from microwave ovens to cribs to furniture to wood products, pistachios. Anything you find in a Walmart store is being moved at that location. They all come in containers. Go ahead.
And well, we had a warehouse workers union, or warehouse workers united, I should say, not a union, on last week talking about the fact that you often don't have access to clean water or any water. And Ruben, because you used to be in a union and now you're not, I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how workers can use their power. A new study just came out from the Economic Policy Institute that found 30% of American workers are expected to hold low-wage jobs in 2020, and the number of temp workers is also on the rise. So this is our future. So what does it take to organize at a non-union shop?
Well, we need to get a little bit more unity. The workers are very much afraid of their jobs. We are on a constant threat basis that if we don't move fast enough or fulfill our quota, that we're going to get fired. They tell us continuously that there's 10 workers, 20 workers waiting for our jobs. The turnover rate at that location is quite high. They bring in new people, and once they find out what the working conditions are there, they don't last very long. The ones that do stay have to be very much on their feet, and the reprisal rate there is very high. Because I've joined this organization, Warehouse Workers United, I wear a T-shirt and I've spoken out. I am a target there. I've been limited to how many hours I work there, and I also am tailed all the time by the supervisor to make sure I don't talk to anybody. The supervisor has no respect for any of the workers there. He has a foul mouth. He talks to us in four-letter words and stuff of that nature and basically threatens us.
And I understand that because you're speaking out, your hours were cut back and you weren't able to make your rent, and so now you're living in a motel.
Correct. And in March of this year, I only worked 3 days out of the entire month. And because of that, I wasn't able to make my rent. And because of that, I was evicted. I do live in a motel. I live day to day. We've gone ahead and pawned everything that we have just to make ends meet. It's very difficult. I wish I could get out of this situation. Being that I'm 61 years old, it is hard for me to find another job.
Mm. Well, let me ask you before we let you go, Ruben, as the Democratic Convention kicks off in Charlottesville, what message would you send to unions about how to strengthen organized labor?
We would want to have a little bit more education. We would want you to start supporting us. We need the support. We need people to actually support the workers there at Mira Loma, because we feel that we're isolated. Nobody really cares about us. But if we find out that there's somebody there that does care for us, we might be able to speak out for our own rights. You know, they don't even give us the right to take a 5-minute break when the temperature inside that warehouse is over 85 degrees. A lot of times it is over 100 degrees, even at the midnight shift. Inside the trailers, it could get up to 110 degrees inside them, even during the evening time. We don't even have fans to cool us off. They don't do that for us.
Well, Ruben, thank you so much for joining us. And I understand that Warehouse Workers United is going to march from the port to the L.A. area to raise awareness about this in the coming weeks.
Right. Yes, we're trying to drum up support and trying to educate the public on what the working conditions are for all warehouse workers. It is a
all right. Well,
go ahead.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Ruben. That's Ruben Valadez. He's a contractor with Ware staff in February, loading and unloading 250 Walmart boxes an hour. And Bill Fletcher, where does someone like a Ruben Valadez, because this seems to be where we're going in terms of temp workers and low-wage workers, where do they fit in to this larger question about the future of organized labor?
Well, there's actually an effort to organize within Walmart, and workers have gotten together with an organization, Our Walmart, I believe it's called, and the reality is that without that level of organization, Walmart won't change. The conditions that that caller was describing simply will not change. The Walmart's model of operation, much like, and actually it's a model that it's set for much of the rest of the retail industry, relies on people that are as vulnerable as the caller, people that are throwaway workers as far as they're concerned. And what we need to be fighting for are real full-time jobs with benefits that pay a decent amount, that are self-respecting jobs. And, you know, when you think about what happened in the 1930s with the reemergence of a labor movement, a lot of the jobs that became well-paid jobs were, prior to the 1930s, paying almost nothing. They were the version then of Walmart jobs. It was through unionization that those jobs changed, and I think that that's what the caller would need.
And, Mike, what are your thoughts on that? I mean, how does this all fit together? Because we often just talk about unions, but the fact is union representation is so low, and according to all these studies, the future is low-wage and temp jobs.
So we got to think outside of organizing under the traditional process, start engaging workers to do the greatest thing like Reuben does. And Reuben is a true American hero. You know, it was funny. Over the weekend, I was thinking to myself, we always celebrate the American heroes on Memorial Day. There's these big movie marathons on, you know, about Memorial Day, about soldiers fighting overseas. But there's no Labor Day movie marathons on TNT or AMC. You never hear about a Labor Day movie marathon. And oftentimes, you know, when workers do stuff like Reuben does, it leads to very life-threatening things. I mean, being someone at Reuben's age, 61, without a job and being retaliated against as a union member is not good for someone's continued health. And I think we got to support them. And I also want to draw this back to another point about the corruption.
And we have about 15 seconds.
Oh, okay. All right. Well, it was great being on the show then.
All right. Well, how about this? We'll do another show about the corruption of, I think you were going to say, liberals and maybe bosses, organized bosses.
Well, I was going to say the woman you were on MSNBC with, Nir Tandon. She's the head of a big liberal think tank, and she's having a reception hosted by Walmart's lobbyists at PNC.
Oh, that's interesting. All right. Well, we'll definitely have to talk about doing a show about that. Mike Elk is a labor reporter with In These Times, and Bill Fletcher is a racial justice and labor activist. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you very, very much.
Thank you. We'll definitely continue this important conversation. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. Here's what's coming up tomorrow. Where is the Obama coalition today? On the next Jour Call, as the Democratic National Convention is underway, we'll talk about the Democratic Party. Support for gay marriage, abortion rights, and organized labor have all been included in a draft of the party's platform this year. So who are the people standing behind the Democrats? And how has support for President Obama changed since 2008? Join us at 10 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. What does it mean to be a Democrat today? It's Jour Call with Holly Kernan and you. We'll be right back.